You're listening to Evil, a true crime podcast. Join me each week as I bring you real people, real stories, real crimes, and the evil they encountered. Hey guys, welcome back. I'm your host, Leslie. So today's episode has to do with child murder and assault. So I want to go ahead and give a quick trigger warning for that. If you don't like that kind of stuff, then go ahead and skip this episode because it's not going to be for you. This case is straight out of Idaho. And before I get started, remember I had told you guys a couple episodes back that I was going to let you guys know what a ligature was by definition. I went ahead and looked it up. So a ligature by definition is a thing used for tying or binding something tightly. So there you go. I guess I wasn't too off base when I was describing it. I just didn't want to go, I didn't want to give you guys incorrect information.
You with the tongue out. You gotta say your name. Girly what? Girly nothing Underwood, right?
This is the story of Geralee Underwood. Geralee was born January 9, 1982. She was born to her parents, Jeff and Joyce Underwood. She was the second child to her parents, and Geralee resided in Pocatello, Idaho with her family. The Underwoods had a total of 6 kids, and Jeff actually wanted 12. But Joyce was like, "We have 6 kids, and that is enough. And can you blame her? I have 2 kids, and they're teenagers, and I feel like that is a handful in itself. But also, I feel like that would be a lot of fun." Now, Joyce wanted to have an even number of kids because she didn't want any of her kids to ever feel left out. She always wanted them to have a buddy or someone that they could turn to. And I thought that was super sweet. Geralee was born 5 weeks early and she weighed 4 pounds and 12 ounces. And her mom, Joyce, wonders that if her daughter somehow knew that her time on Earth would be cut short, and if that's why Geralee was in such a rush to get here. Since she did come early, she spent about 9 or 10 days in the hospital. She was described as always happy and always having a smile on her face. And Geralee was a cute little girl. She had glasses and thick, wavy, golden brown hair, and she had this cute little bucktooth smile. She was described as very loving, and her parents say that she liked to take care of people. She was an amazing sister who took great care of her siblings. She was known to not stay angry for long. And she did really well in school. She attended church regularly with her family. She loved to dance, so much so that she learned how to clog dance. She enjoyed reading and spending time outside, and she was nurtured and protected by her parents. In September 1992, at only 11 years old, she started a newspaper route with her brother. Locals and neighbors really liked her a lot, so they often tipped her. The route was close to their home, and they could walk to and from. Her parents warned her about stranger danger and tried their best to teach them about how to be safe. Geralee's parents knew most of the customers and felt confident that they were safe members of the community. On June 28, 1993, the day of her abduction, Geralee had an orthodontist appointment, and then after that she came home and she got ready to deliver the papers. Joyce remembers that Geralee wanted to take her bike, but she had a flat tire. And Joyce, being the good mom that she is, stepped outside and fixed the bike. But when she came back inside to tell Geralee that the bike was ready, she had already left to deliver the paper. Geralee left her house late in the afternoon, and she visited each of her customers on her route like she usually did. Jeff recalls that on that fateful day, he and his wife Joyce were out doing some things in the garden when someone tried to reach them on the phone. When they didn't get a response, they came over to the house. They informed them that they had seen Geralee get into a car. At first, her parents tried not to panic. Apparently, there was a neighbor who would sometimes give her a ride home, so they thought that that would possibly be the case. As time progressed and she wasn't home, her parents traced her steps to try and see where the last houses she made it to were. Y'all, can you even imagine? Oof, I have anxiety, so I tend to worry about anything and everything just in general. So I would have been freaking out at this point. Once they learned that she had been shoved into a car, her parents immediately called the police. The Underwoods filed a report of an abduction, and a manhunt was underway. Members of the Church of the Latter-day Saints, who the Underwoods were members of, fully participated in the search for Jerilee. At least two witnesses came forward. An elderly neighbor who lived on the corner had just got done paying for her newspaper subscription, and as she was looking out her window, she noticed a male from the car suddenly grab Jerilee and forcing her into the driver's side of the car to the passenger side. The male quickly jumped in the car and sped the fuck away. This happened near Carter and Main Street. The incident had occurred only a half a mile away from the Underwoods residence. Can you imagine being that neighbor? I would have shit my pants. Ugh, I would have honestly gives me goosebumps. The detectives got a description of the suspect and the vehicle. A white male, anywhere from 30 to 35 years of age, approximately 5'7 to 5'8, wearing a plaid shirt and a hat, and he was clean shaven. Jerilee had auburn hair, glasses, and she was wearing a jazz t-shirt with a purple band around her leg. The descriptions of both the kidnapper and Jerilee were circulated in the form of flyers and news bulletins. They dispatched that info to all of their units. Detectives looked, and they were determined to find her. A couple of hours after they had received a general description from one witness stating a cream-colored vehicle was seen abducting her, detectives got a second, more accurate description of the vehicle from another witness. That gentleman was sure it was a General Motors product, 5 or 10 years old, medium-sized sedan with a darker roof and a yellowish or light beige cream-colored body. Her mother, Joyce, said she was expecting Jerilee to come home any minute, eagerly trying to show her how much tips she had made. She was such a hard worker. She looked out the window and waited in hopes that her daughter would come home. When she didn't come home that night, her parents were devastated. They cried and held each other. Like, I have no words. That's so fucking sad. So sad. Joy said later that night, she felt a sense of peace, and during her prayers, she got a feeling that Jerilee was safe. Unfortunately, she would later find out that Jerilee had already been dead around that time. Days passed with no information on Jerilee's whereabouts. Police checkpoints littered all of East Idaho, and national media started covering the disappearance. The decision to assign the investigation to Scott Shaw was made by Captain Lynn Harris and Lieutenant Kirk Nelson. The department had sent him to a number of specialized training schools dealing with violent crimes, so it was decided he would take the lead on Jerilee's case. Unfortunately, one of the first things they had to look at the family. So, if you listen to crime or just in general, the first things that investigators do when it's a missing person's case or just a missing person's case, whether it's an adult or a child, is they're going to look at that person's inner circle. They're going to look at her family. They're going to look at, she didn't work because she was a child, but if she was an adult, they would look at any of her past relationships. If she went to school with people, you know, people that she worked with, but again, she was a child. So they're going to look at, her family, and they're going to always look closely at that family dynamic and see if there's anything abnormal or if there's anything that sticks out. Members of the Saint Latter-day Church started coming out to support the Underwoods, and it became fairly quickly that the Underwoods had nothing to do with Jerilee's disappearance. So detectives went ahead and ruled them out. Jerilee's parents remember feeling disheartened at the insinuation that they could be the ones that had something to do with their daughter's disappearance. Eventually, investigators received information from the FBI stating that the individual they were looking for would plan his steps and his moves. He was an organized offender. Sergeant Shaw didn't agree. He believed that because the crime was committed in the middle of the afternoon in broad daylight on a busy street with people out in their yards, that it was more than likely a stranger abduction. He thought that that was more likely that it was a stranger abduction than it was somebody she actually knew. According to witness accounts, she didn't seem in distress before being shoved into the car, and that led investigators to believe that the perpetrator had given her a false sense of safety before abducting her. Investigators started to believe that it was someone who lived in their community. Oh, I don't like that. It fucking freaks me the fuck out. How scary. Even as days went by, the Underwoods held tight to their fate and community, and remained hopeful that their daughter would come home safe. A week after her abduction, James Edwards Woods, 45, was taken into custody on account of aggravated kidnapping. He wasn't resistant and admitted his guilt regarding Underwood's murder, as well as two other rapes and several robberies committed days after her murder. After being questioned for a while, he led investigators to Snake River, near Idaho Falls. He told investigators what happened the night he abducted Geralee and what he did to her. And guys, this guy is a fucking monster. Fucking hate this dude. He's fucking, hate him. He told investigators that he had been eating dinner with his cousin, who was on the paper delivery route that Geralee took, when Geralee came around to collect her payment. He told her that the check was faulty and asked her to return it to him for cash. He waited until she was looking through her bag, distracted, before shoving her into his car and driving away. Ooh, hate this guy. What a piece of fucking garbage. He told his cousin that he was going out to buy alcohol. He drove a long distance, avoiding stops and checkpoints. He told the police that Geralee had asked him why he had kidnapped her and talked to him about the Mormon faith they shared. Y'all, like, she was 11 years old. 11. And he, like, she was just trying to make a little bit of coin for herself. A little bit of money. Like, being an independent queen, and this fucking douchebag just abducts her. And the fact that she sat there and asked him why he'd kidnapped her, I can't fucking fathom it. It's so fucking sad. It's heartbreaking. Woods held Geralee captive for over a day, during which time he sexually molested her, raped her, and then shot her in the head with a .22 caliber pistol. He shot her in the head when she knelt down near the river for a bathroom break. Like, what a fucking coward. I can't. He then hid her body by covering it with brush. Woods later returned to the site of the murder. He undressed her corpse and mutilated the body by removing the sex organs and severing the arms, head, and legs. He threw her clothing and body parts into Snake River. The body was later recovered, and they found everything except her right hand and her right calf. Y'all, like, this man is fucking, like, horrible. Absolutely horrible. She was 11 years old. The Underwoods and their children were absolutely devastated by the loss of Geralee. They couldn't even see her body when they laid her to rest. And how heartbreaking is that? Like, can you even fucking imagine? So sad. Jeff ended up going through, he went through counseling. And he went through counseling in order to get rid of his anger and rage that he felt towards Woods. And the way he did it was kind of in an unconventional way. It was an unconventional method. And they gave him a scarecrow-like figure, and that scarecrow-like figure was supposed to represent James Woods, and he would direct his fury and frustrations towards the mannequin. And it was just a different outside of the box way of having therapy, but it was incredibly effective for him. So who the fuck is James Woods? James Edwards Woods was born James Godwin on December 9th, 1947 in Pensacola, Florida. When he was born, Godwin's father, Sherman, an alcoholic, was imprisoned in Fort Leavenworth, and that prompted his mother, Hazel Johnson, to leave the state with the two boys and move to Idaho. Woods apparently had a normal childhood until 1955, when at 8 years old, he witnessed the tragic death of his mom. She died while in a fire, and she was saving two other workers at a potato warehouse. And, like, talk about emotional damage and, like, trauma. Holy shit. It's like that TikTok. It's not, like, emotional damage. Like, what the fuck? At 8 years old. But also, like, his mom was a fucking hero. She died, like, helping her coworkers, trying to get him out of a fire. And another thing, like, potato warehouse factory. Why the fuck, like... Where's OSHA? Like, I'm so, but his mom was a literal angel. Godwin would later go on to claim that in his distress, he tried to put his arm around the waist of a nearby woman who, instead of consoling him, simply pushed him away. Woods claimed that this gesture caused him to develop a hatred towards women, which was greatly aggravated whenever they resembled the woman who had brushed him off. Shortly after the tragedy, he was adopted by his aunt and uncle in Idaho Falls, who changed his name to James Edwards Woods. During this time period, Wood claimed to have been abused both physically and mentally, which caused him to lash out frequently. Unable to control him, his adopted parents sent him to the Idaho Youth Training Center in St. Anthony, where Woods attempted to escape on 8 different occasions. But he was always caught and returned. And, like, bro, you would think after, like, the first, the second, like, the third, the fourth, like, after the first, fourth time, you would think, like, he would stop. But no, like, he kept going, like, 8 times, my dude. 8 times. Okay, 8 times. But anyways. In 1963, his father was released from prison, and he offered to take care of Woods. And Woods accepted, and he boarded the first bus to Shreveport, Louisiana, where Sherman had moved to. And they lived together for some time until Woods moved to Missouri to enter flight school. He then married a woman there in 1966. However, he claimed that shortly after his marriage, he began raping women in Missouri and Illinois. And, like, dude, what the fuck? Like, I don't get it. Ooh, I don't get it. In 1967, Woods moved to his brother's house in Boise City. And that same year, he was arrested for breaking into an apartment where he stabbed 2 women and attempted to rape one of them. What the fuck? This dude is a fucking predator. He was arrested and lodged at the Boise Parish Jail to await charges on aggravated battery. While in there, he suffered severe burns following an incident in which he stole his cellmate's blanket. In response, the man threw a cup of burning lighter fluid on him. And, like, if I could give this man, well, I don't know what this man was in there for, but, like, yes, I would put some money on your commissary for that because he fucking deserved it. That guy was a piece of shit and, like, good for you. I hope you didn't get in extra trouble, but, like, good for you. Woods would eventually be convicted of the charges, and he was only sentenced to 10 years. 10 years. 10 years, guys. He was imprisoned at the Louisiana State Penitentiary, but he would be paroled on August 18th, 1971 for good behavior. Are you fucking kidding me? After his release, Wood took on a job as a truck driver, traveling cross-country. During the late 1970s, he and his brother committed various robberies across Louisiana, Texas, and Arkansas. Like, what the fuck? Why? They're just letting this guy do whatever the fuck he wants to do. It's fucking insane. In 1977, he was arrested for robbing a pizzeria in Baton Rouge, but he was released on bail and moved back to the northern part of the state. He again took on as a job as a truck driver for an oil company in Boise City and married a Shreveport woman, but was soon arrested for raping a woman in Lincoln Parish. Woods was convicted of this crime and given a few years imprisonment, remaining in prison until November 6, 1986, when he was released for good behavior. Like, what the absolute fuck? Clearly, he's a sexual sadist. Clearly, he's violent. Like, why are they giving him so many opportunities to go victimize more women? I just hate it so much. After working again as a truck driver, and for a short time, he also worked on a tugboat in southern Louisiana, he returned to Shreveport in 1987, where he married a woman named Yvonne and had a son in 1989. Woods eventually moved to Grand Cane, but he was forced to flee after a 14-year-old relative of his wife filed a complaint to the police claiming that he had raped her at the photo lab where he worked. Like, what a fucking monster. Really? Like, a 14-year-old girl? Somebody that's related to your wife at work? Like, I just hate this. I hate him so much. He headed for Idaho, where he had some relatives, but on the way, he passed through a suburb in St. Louis, Missouri, where he kidnapped an 18-year-old, Jamie Massengill, in October of 1992. Woods drove her to the nearby forest, where he raped her and shot her in the head. Miraculously, she survived. Guys, she survived. Can you believe that? She freaking survived. Woods eventually arrived in Idaho on November 1st, and he moved in with a cousin. A few months after his arrest, Woods suddenly admitted to another crime, the 1976 murder of 33-year-old Shirley Coleman. Coleman, an employee at the Western Electric plant in Greenwood, Louisiana, was apparently abducted from a parking lot while she was doing her Christmas shopping. Her skeletal remains were found in a rural area west of Shreveport on January 7, 1981. In his confession, Woods claimed that he had driven her to the General Electric industrial plant, where he had raped her in the back seat of her gold and beige Oldsmobile before driving Coleman out in the woods and shooting her in the back of the head. It's just... I have no words. He's a monster. He's an absolute monster. Following his confession, authorities also started investigating him in relation to the 1979 disappearances of 18-year-old Dottie Gay and Daria Vall, both of whom had vanished within months of each other in Shreveport. While there were initial suspicions that these were just simple, boastful confessions, investigators considered them credible enough to look into Woods further. In the end, however, he was never charged with any of these cases due to a lack of physical evidence linking him to the crimes. During his trial, Wood pleaded guilty to Jerilee's murder, much to the displeasure of his lawyer. Subsequently, he was found guilty and sentenced to death. A few weeks after the sentence, he filed papers to waive all future appeals and speed up the execution process, but was later convinced by his new lawyers to reconsider. In the appeal that followed, attorneys Rolf Kinn and John Adams argued that their client's sentence should be overturned due to ineffective counsel. This stemmed from the claim that the previous lawyer, Monte Whittier, had convinced Wood, a Mormon, in the same congregation as him, that he could be forgiven through blood atonement. Lawyers assigned to Wood's case would accuse the previous public defender of deferring from his role as a lawyer to prioritize church teachings and letting his hatred of Woods influence the case. Whittier denied these claims, saying that his profession remained separate from his faith and that he had no conflict of interest in defending a Mormon murderer who had killed a Mormon girl, calling Wood an uncooperative client. And yes, as you should, the fucking shade. Yes, defend yourself. This claim of victimhood was laughable because Woods was never active in the church and at this point had been excommunicated by the Latter-day Saints for his murder charges. Woods would also go through changes of heart very often in his case and used his religious beliefs to try and appear innocent. Like, believe what you want, but like, this dude is just gross. Justice Lynn Windmill denied the request. She said the following, "While Whittier's conduct was indeed flawed, it was not severe enough to affect Woods' decision." Jerilee's parents spoke out against what they presumed negative stereotypes and prejudices against their faith and asked that the legal proceedings be kept separate.
District Judge Lynn Windmill used a few words to describe Woods, and he described him as a cold-blooded, pitiless slayer. He also expressed the belief that had Woods not been caught, he would have continued on his spree of violence and crime. The Arizona case, which ruled that all those sentenced to capital punishment must have been sentenced by a jury rather than a judge, impacted Woods' sentencing as well. Moving back and forth between appealing and not appealing to expedite his execution, the case was opened again for retrial and resentences.
Woods died in prison from cardiac arrest after a long medical history, a relieving circumstance for the victim's family who were informed before the public. Jeff and Joyce Underwood spoke to the media soon after and relayed feelings of relief, stating that their belief in providence and justice reassured them that Woods, while spared the death penalty, would not be spared divine retribution and he would get his just reward. Meaning, even though he didn't get put to death, because that is something that Joyce and Jeff really wanted to, because they believe since he took the life of their daughter so violently that he deserved to get his taken from him as well. But since that didn't happen, they feel at peace with the fact that he's getting his, whether it's on this earth or in whatever lifetime that he is in now. So yes, guys, that was the case of Jera Lee Underwood. It's just so fucking unfortunate, you know. She was just out there trying to do her thing, girl boss it, and this fucking douchebag who should have been put away fell through whatever cracks and just victimized more people and ultimately took her life. So it's just super, super, super fucking unfortunate.
To stay connected with the podcast, follow us on Instagram at evilpodcast88. We're also on TikTok at evilpodcast, and we're on Twitter at evilpodcast88. I am working on making a Facebook group, and I do have a domain name for the website. Just got to work on that. But yeah, guys, comment, like, share, review. Let us know what you think. That's how the podcast grows. And we will catch you, and I will catch you next time. Take care.